Thanks. Recall what we are trying to show. We are trying to show if we have uniformly definable family of finite sets, then there is upper bound on the side of sets, some k. This is our goal. And so we look at small subsets of M2. So we look at sets in M parameterized by elements in M. So the whole set is A is N, M squared, and it's small, meaning almost all fibers is our M squared. Almost all fibers are finite. So fibers where set is infinite, we have only finitely many such fibers. And we need to find upper bound on the size of finite fibers. And the actual claim is we can divide the whole M into subintervals so that above each subinterval, the number of points is the same. It differs from subinterval to subinterval, but the number of points must be the same. Even more, we want to show we can divide the whole line into subintervals so that above each subinterval, our small set looks like the union of finitely many graphs of definable functions. This is our goal. This is how set should look like. On some subintervals, there may be no points, somewhere maybe only one. And we don't care about points within intervals. There are finitely many such points. They are not so essential. This is the goal. So we define nice points. Nice point where set A looks like a graph of a function. So point on A is called normal if there is some small open box so that A intersection with the box looks like the graph of continuous function. This typical normal point. And the first we want to show the number of normal points. So A almost everywhere is normal. So G of A denotes the set of all normal points, where A looks locally like the graph of a function. And now we do a series of claims. First claim, so we have our small set. And suppose the projection of a set on the first coordinate is infinite. Then we can find definable function, some interval I, and definable function f from I to m, such that graph of this function is inside our set. And proof is very simple. So we have our set A somewhere here. Projection is infinite, pi of A. We can pick some interval I, not, such that if each point is I naught, the fibers are finite. So if x is I naught, implies ax is finite. Because it's small. Now, for each point in I0, fibers are finite, we can pick f of x to be the least point in the fiber. The least, point in the fiber. Finitely many points, pick the least one. We have definable function from I0 to A. Definable. By continuity lemma, there is subinterval where where f is continuous. F is continuous. It proves the lemma. So if projection is infinite, we can always, inside A, we can find the graph of continuous function from I to A. It does give us yet plenty of nodal points, because nodal means you can separate graph from all other points. So now, second claim. Again, we have small set. We have I open interval and continuous function from I into M whose graph is inside A. There we can find a point in I, so x is not f at this point, is normal in A. So you can separate the graph around this point from all other points in A. Proof is very simple. So we have our interval I. We have continuous definable function whose graph is inside A. Again, we can pick subinterval and assume that all fibers are finite. Decreasing I slightly if you need to. And now we can pick for each x inside I in the fiber, we can pick point just below the graph and above the graph for each point. And now, again, we have two functions. They have definable functions from I into set. It's called F1, F2. And now, using monotonicity and continuity, we can pick subinterval where all functions are continuous and monotone. Can assume F1, F, F2, continuous and monotone. So F1 point is the first point less than f of x, or largest element in the set minus infinity f of x sup. Right? It is a section. You should be careful, we also allowed values to be minus infinity plus infinity. Okay? So basically you say, if there is no point below f of x, you pick negative infinity. If there is a point, pick largest one. And now, once you have continuous and monotone, it's very easy to pick small open box that separates F1 and F2 from F inside box. So point is going to be normal. So it means if you take set of all normal points, then the rest, the complement, take projection is going to be finite. Okay, so if you now throw away finitely many points, so we can divide I into subintervals, so that above each point in subinterval, our set is normal. So picture now is, we can divide our line into subintervals. Above each point in subinterval, all points are normal. So A locally looks like graph of a function. But only locally. We need to get graphs, just units of graphs. Now we have only local conditions. So problems are points in the closure of A and points where our graphs go to infinity. These are only obstacles to get union of the graphs. So first we need to take care of the closure. So first claim, if A is small set, then the closure is also small. And the proof is for 215. Assume closure is not small. So there is some interval in the base where all fibers are infinite. They contain interval. So playing around with the boundaries of intervals above each point, Montanicity and continuity, we can find definable open set U inside A, closure of A. So our closure contains U. Now A is going to be dense in U. So let's take A prime. A intersect U. So A prime is dense in U. And now let's look also at the closure. Okay. Is it enough? Yeah. A prime is dense in U. It's dense in U means projection. What it means, but it implies projection of A prime is infinite intersection. If projection of A prime is infinite, we can find inside A prime normal point. Normal point in A prime. So this point where A prime locally around the point looks like the graph of a continuous function. But then, inside this open neighborhood, our A prime is closed. It's not dense. Not dense. Contradiction. The closure of small set is closed. First one statement. Second, actually even stronger, projection of the, I think it's called boundary, okay, closure minus set itself is actually finite. Second statement. And it's also not hard, just playing around with normal points. So to prove 216, assume the projection of the closure of A minus A is infinite. But then, closure of A is small set. Any subset of a small set is small, definable subset. This set is small. Right? So we can find normal point inside closure of A. Or it's small implies we can find continuous function from some open interval going into this set. There is definable continuous f from the interval I into closure of A minus A. This is the graph of our F. But now look at F as going from I to the closure of A. Closure of A is small, so you can find point for the graph of A. Normal is the closure of A. The closure of A. And this point is on the graph of F. So we have point and some open neighborhood. So inside this neighborhood, there are no any other points in the closure of A except for the graph of function. But our graph is outside of the whole set A. So it means this set cannot be in the closure of A, because we separate from the whole, all points in the closure of A. graph lives inside closure of A minus A. So this open neighborhood, there are no any other points in the closure of A, so no points from A in the whole open neighborhood. Does not intersect. Contradiction. Because the graph is in the closure of A. Okay, so now we have the number of bad points, projections of the closure of A minus A is finite. We can throw it away and actually get division into subintervals, so above each subinterval, A is actually closed set. So now, after subdivision, on each subinterval, our set looks like actually union of graphs of the function. We cannot claim yet that the number of points in the fibers is the same everywhere, because some graphs, some function may go to infinity. So when we move, we are going to lose points on this graph. Have 2 points above this point, only 1 point above this point. So now you take care of points where function goes to infinity. So we look at points in A and call point in A locally bounded if A is locally bounded, there is some interval I and interval J. So so A lives inside this box above interval I. This locally, set A is locally bounded near A. So claim is, again, if you look at points where A is locally bounded, it's almost everywhere, at all but finitely many points. Proof, the same trick, Montanicity. I will just get locally bounded action from above. So to show 217, assume not. So we have infinitely many points where A is not locally bounded. To be locally bounded is definable property. Locally bounded, there is interval I and J, so I cross J contains intersection. If we have infinite definable set, we can pick interval inside. So if not, we can find interval I, so that A is not locally bounded. Bounded at any point A in I. So A is a small set, almost all fibers are finite. We can shrink slightly I and assume all fibers are finite. And now, again, for each point in I, we can pick largest point in the fiber. We can define F1 of X to be sup of AX, F2 of X to be inf of AX. We get 2 definable functions. F2. Now use Montanicity, continuity, get subinterval where they're continuous and monotone, and then we get box. So we get only finitely many points where A is not locally bounded. So now, in all cases, you have only finitely many points in projections. So we use this point to divide M into subinterval. So now we divide it by these bad points. And now on each interval, what we have, A is locally closed. Inside each interval, every point in A is normal. So if you look at typical AI plus 1, what we have, A is locally bounded above each point. At each point, A is actually normal. Plus, inside this cylinder, above this point, A is closed. Because I should throw away all points in the projection of closure minus A. Because it's closed, it's not hard to see that actually this graph should go from the left side to the right side. Because A is closed. They cannot go to infinity. They're actually going to be just the functions. And this finishes the proof. If you have above some point exactly k points, then when you go right or left, they cannot disappear. So above each point in the interval, you must have at least k points. If at some point you have k. Since it's true for any point in interval, number of points is constant. Another way to see it, pick a point, or pick any k, and show the number of points in the base where fiber has exactly k points is open and closed. It's very easy from these conditions. Since every interval is definably connected, we are done. The only open and closed definable sets are empty sets or the whole interval. So it finishes the proof. For small sets, we can divide the base M. So above each subinterval, our set is a union of continuous functions. Union of graphs of continuous functions. If you want to, you can subdivide and get functions to be monotone by piecewise monotonicity. So it finishes the proof of this case. Implies now that we have upper bound on the number of finite fibers. This uniform bound on uniform family of finite sets, parameterized by elements of M. Divide into subintervals and pick maximum above each interval. It's going to be bound. Well, these are the restatement what I said. We can subdivide into finitely many intervals. Above each interval, the set is the union of finitely many graphs of continuous functions, exactly k points. Number k depends on interval, how many graphs. Above some intervals, we may have 0 points. So it takes care of the case of finite subsets in M, parameterized by elements of M, only the case of sets inside M squared. To do the full uniform finiteness, we need to look at Mn plus 1, etc., etc. It is done by induction, basically following the same ideas. Now, set is going to be small in Mn plus 1 if the set of points where fibers are infinite is going to be small in Mn. And play more or less the same game, plus extra to get sufficiently many continuous functions. But I will refer to Lau's book. So doing it, we actually get even more. It goes through so-called cell decomposition. So what is a cell, notion of a cell? Notion of a cell, or K cell in MN, is defined by induction on N. So C in MN is a K cell. So there are two parameters, N, just ambient space where cell lives in, and K. K basically is the dimension of the cell. And by induction, what are cells in M? Well, zero cell, zero dimensional cell, is a point. One cell is an open interval inside M. And by O-minimality, every definable set is a finite union of cells. Suppose now we know what are K cells in MN. Let's go, let's say, to M2. The first case, so just look at M2. We have M and M here. So we have zero cells in M points. One cells in M are intervals. So if you have a continuous function from our base cell into M, then the graph of function is going to be also K cell. So we have K cell and look at the graph of continuous function from this cell into M. It's going to be K cell, but now inside MN plus 1. It's a typical example of one cell in M2, graph of one cell on the function. Zero cell, take graph, you get a point, zero cell. To increase dimension, second case, suppose we have cell C in the base space MN, and two continuous functions from cell C into M, F and G, so that F is less than G everywhere. And F and G can take values minus or plus infinity. F and G. Then, if you look at all points above C between F and G, strictly between, it's going to be K plus 1 cell in MN. So K increased by 1, dimension goes by 1. This notion of a cell. These are very simple operations how to produce cells in MN starting from a line. So notice the notion of a cell depends on ordering of coordinates. We start with the very first coordinate, points interval, apply functions, look at graphs, or region squeezed between graphs of functions, and go one by one. This notion of a cell, very simple sets. Now I think this bunch of exercises, looking at definition by induction, the first, if you look at N cell inside MN, then you get actually open set in MN. We always take regions between graphs of two functions. So we always contain open box. On the other hand, if you look at K cell in MN, is K less than N, so dimension kind of less than the ambient space, then it has empty interior. It's also a very simple exercise by induction on dimension. Now, if you look even at finite union of cells of small dimension inside MN, the complement is going to be dense in MN. So it's nowhere dense set, complement is going to be dense. 4 is not so interesting. 5, if you look at K cell inside MN, and K, let's say, less than N, it's not going to be open in MN. However, there is a projection to some K coordinates. We need to pick right coordinates. So that this projection is actually homeomorphism of your original cell with a cell inside MK. So each case cell is homeomorphic to case cell inside MK, that's always the open cell, under appropriate projection. Basically, each time we apply graphs of functions, gives us projection. Now, again, by induction, every cell is going to be definably connected. Basically, if you look at cell in M2, the two cell, it looks like up to homeomorphism as a product of two intervals, I cross J, something between two functions. Now, what may happen we want to define definably connected components. And if you look, even let's say it's an open square, the square is definably connected. However, we can partition this square into three cells, one cell, C0, another cell, C2, one more cell, C3. So it's partitioned into three cells. We still want to look at the cell partition and decide if our original set is definably connected or not. That's why we say two cells are adjacent if the closure of one cell intersects second cell. In this case, C2 and C0 are adjacent. Closure of C2 contains C0 intersect. C3 and C0 are adjacent. So exercise, suppose we have set which is a union of cells. Then the cell set is definably connected if and only if basically all our cells are connected by paths going through adjacent cells. So we can enumerate our cells, there are finitely many, so that every two consecutive cells are adjacent. And then our set is going to be definably connected. It's if and only if condition. And as I said, the cell, notion of a cell, depends on the ordering of coordinates. So it's very easy to find example of a cell in R2 relative to standard ordering of coordinates. So that if you change coordinates, permute coordinates, so you take the inverse of a set, you switch X and Y, the set is not going to be a cell. So notion of a cell is very sensitive to the ordering of coordinates. This kind of disadvantage of cells. And now we define a cell decomposition. So cell decomposition of MN is actually a very special case of partition of MN into cell. So cell decomposition of a line M is just finite union of points and intervals. It's partition by finitely many points and intervals. That's the partition of M into cells. For MN plus 1, cell decomposition is this very special partition of MN plus 1. It is partition of MN plus 1 into cells, but so that if you take projections, you'll get cells in MN. So for example, two projections cannot overlap. It's not going to be partition even of MN. So if you take projections of this special partition of MN plus 1 into MN, then two projections are either the same or disjoint and form a partition of MN. This cell decomposition. Special partition of MN into cells. So if you go back and project of the first K coordinates, we get cell partition of MK. This is cell decomposition. And one more. If you have a definable set in MN and cell decomposition of MN, then we say the decomposition is compatible with A if every cell is either in A or disjoint from A. In other words, A is a finite union of cells from this decomposition. Now the fundamental cell decomposition theorem. Pick finitely many sets, A1 through AK, definable, in MN. Then there is a cell decomposition of MN compatible with each AI. So each AI is going to be union of finitely many cells. And the same as for the line, that each function is almost everywhere continuous on some intervals. Given any definable function from A to M, where A is definable subset of MN, we can find cell decomposition of MN compatible with A, so that F is continuous on every cell. Of course, relation between behavior of F on two different cells, well, there's no any relation, but on each cell is going to be continuous. So each function piecewise continuous, where piecewise means we have cell decomposition and F is continuous on every cell. So proof is done by induction of N in a sense, and we basically did proof for N equals 2. And to do extra steps, step by step, we need to find sufficiently many continuous functions. We had a lot of functions continuous on intervals of M, every function piecewise continuous. And this is very simple claim, which allows to build continuous functions by induction on the domain. So take any open set in MN, take any interval I and M, and let F be function from U cross M into M. So you want to build more functions in higher dimensions. Assume we have a lot of continuous functions on U. So assume that for each U in U, this function in the second coordinate only is continuous and monotone on I. We have plenty of such functions. And also, if you fix R, we have function continuous on the whole U. So in two coordinates, if you pick one coordinate relative to another, it behaves very, very nicely. Then actually F is continuous on the whole U cross M. There is no definability, nothing actually required to prove it. Just very basic game with continuous functions. Using this claim, it's possible to build a lot of continuous functions in all dimensions by induction. These are basically main ingredients of cell decomposition theorem. But proof is long, plenty of bookkeeping in some sense. So what it does, some consequences of cell decomposition. So first, let's define notion, definably connected components of a set X. So definably connected component of a cell is a maximal definable, definably connected subset. It's not clear a priori why such maximum set exists, existence of definably connected components. First claim, for every non-empty definable set X, we have only finitely many definably connected components. They are open and closed in X and form a partition of X. Proof, take cell decomposition of X, partition X into cell. And now to realize if a definable subset or union of the cells is definably connected or not, it's pure combinatorial. You just need to look at adjacent cells to build maximal definably connected set. So it boils down to pure combinatorics, looking at cells. And now, because it's just pure combinatorics, looking at cells, we actually have, well, upper bound on the number of definably connected components. But first, more or less, observation. Let's take definable sets in MK plus 1. Pick point NMK, and by XA, we actually denote the fiber, as usual, in the second coordinate. Because our cell decomposition is built by induction on dimension, it's basically observation. take a cell decomposition of mk plus 1. Pick any point in mk. And look now at our fibers above A of cells from D, dA. This is going to be cell decomposition of mn. Not hard. Just follows by induction on cells, by inductive definition. The cells are constructed this way. And now corollary, take any uniformly definable family of subsets of mn. So our parameter is from mk, and xa are defined using a uniformly. Then there is k, so that each xa has at most k definably connected components. Proof. Take any set, definable set x. Take cell decomposition of x. Show that the number of definably connected components of x cannot be bigger than the number of cells in cell decomposition. It's easy. Each cell is connected. So now, xa comes from a huge ambient set x looking at the fibers. Take cell decomposition of x. Let's say it has k cells. Then each fiber, by proposition, is also a union of k cells. So each fiber will have at most k definably connected components. So you have uniform bound on the number of connected components. And now, if each fiber is finite, then the size is exactly the number of connected components. So we have a bound k on the uniform family of finite sets. So for each uniformly definable family, there is number k such that the size of finite fibers is at most k. So if size is greater than k, the fiber is infinite. Uniform finiteness. And this implies what we are looking for. If M is elementarily equivalent to M, then N is also O-minimal. In N also, every definable set is finite union of points and intervals. It's exercise. Derive it from uniform finiteness. So it finishes, well, big and very important result that O-minimality is preserved under elementary equivalence. And on the way of proving Axis result, we used, well, all main or fundamental properties of sets definable in all minimal structures. Cell decomposition and piecewise continuity of definable functions. This is the first part of my talks. Second part, we want to define dimension of a set. And so we fix again O-minimal structure M, and we are going to define two notions of dimensions. One is some kind of algebraic or combinatorial, second topological, and we show they actually they are agree. It's a kind of standard combinatorial or algebraic definition, standard model theoretic definition, second is topological. Example, the same happens in algebraic geometry over complex numbers. If you take any algebraic variety, let's say defined over countable subfield, we need to have enough generic points, and it's always defined into some finite, well, finite generic subfield called K. Then there are two notions of dimensions we can define to K. You can define topological dimension, a subset of C to the power N, or it's a half of real dimension. Second notion is pure algebraic. We are looking at maximum of transcendence degree of elements in X over the base field K. And, well, it's one of the results, the topological dimension coincides with this maximum of algebraic dimensions. Transcendence degree of elements in X. Take tuple in X, let's say it has n elements, and dimension is going to be maximal possible number of independent elements in this tuple. It equals to topological dimension. So you want to do it the same approach, topological equals algebraic, in any or minimal structure. So you want to define the notion of algebraic dimension. And the standard model theoretic definition of algebraic dimension, take any subset in M and element B in M. Then B is algebraic over A if there is a formula over A that is true on B, and this formula has only finitely many solutions. So up to finitely many elements, up to K, A defines all first properties of B. You can somehow distinguish B over A definably from all other elements up to finitely many sets. So A defines finite set and B is inside. We say B is definable over A if actually we can define B by the by a formula over A. So phi has parameters only from A and has unique solution, exactly this B. So two notions of algebraic and definable. Algebraic, A defines finite set and B belongs to it. Definable means A actually describes B completely in a first order way. There's a formula whose solution is only this element B. And algebraic closure of A is a set of all algebraic elements over A, and definable closure of A, all elements definable over A. So usually these two notions are different. Algebraic closure usually differs from definable closure. Let's say in the field case, look at square root of 2, you can definitely define square root of 2 over Q by formula x squared equals 2, but this formula has two solutions, square root of 2 minus square root of 2. And over Q, we cannot distinguish between these two solutions. If Q is just a field, no orderings. By Galois theory, there is a permutation of C that fixes Q and permutes square root of 2 and minus square root of 2. So square root of 2 cannot be indefinable closure. But in all minimal case, actually, ACL and DCL are the same. If B, well, DCL is always inside ACL, it's much stronger. But if B is an algebraic closure of A, it means there is a formula over A, phi, and phi has solutions only of phi of X are some elements B0, B1, Bk, and B is one of these elements. Because if we have ordering, we can order all solutions of phi of X, and now we can distinguish one element from another. B0 is going to be the least element among the solutions. B1 is going to be second least among all k solutions, etc., etc. So you can always describe B completely. In this case, you just say it is second least element among all solutions of phi of x. So defines B uniquely. So ACL equals DCL, but to do dimension type arguments, define dimensions, we need exchange lemma. So it works in the same way as we define dimension of vector spaces. So define dimension of vector spaces as a maximal number of independent elements, and we need to argue this number does not depend on the choice of basis. And also the same happens in algebraic case. When we define transcendence degree on field extension, the degree equals the maximum number of algebraically independent elements. And then we need to argue this number doesn't depend on actually maximal number of algebraically independent elements. They all have the same size. And to do arguments in both cases, it actually follows from so-called exchange lemma. So exchange lemma says we have A in M and two elements B and C. Suppose B is an ACL of AC, but not in the ACL of A. Then C is in ACL of A. It's not true in general for ACL. It's always true in all minimal structures. This exchange is a very special property. So why is it true in all minimal structures? First of all, in our case, ACL equals DCL. So for simplicity, let's assume A equals empty set. Otherwise, we just always say parameters from A. Suppose now B. B is an algebraic closure of A and C. C is an algebraic closure. Oops, should be B. In 3-2. Conclusion is that C is an ACL of A and B. Thank you very much, Carol. It's extremely important. Otherwise, closure is trivial. So we can interchange B and C. And the proof is, assume... it follows. Because if C is an algebraic closure of A, B is an algebraic closure of AC, B is going to be in the closure of A. So why is it true? Why we can interchange? So we have B in the algebraic closure of C. In our case, we are in the O-minimal case, B is going to be the definable closure of C. So we have formula over empty sets. It's true on B and C, and also true, B is the only solution. Then we can basically slightly change phi, and assume that phi defines a graph or a function. Look at all elements where we have exactly one solution, we have the graph of some function. So we have that B equals f of C for some zero definable function f, empty definable function f. So f is definable over empty set, and B is the value of f at C. By continuity and spontaneity, f is piecewise continuous and monotone. So we can divide intervals of the whole line so that on each interval f is continuous and monotone. Each element in this division can be picked to be in the definable closure of the empty set. Let's say function is strictly increasing from minus infinity to a zero. Pick a zero to be sup of all elements, x, so the function is strictly increasing from minus infinity to x. Take sup, it's such a unique element, a zero. This formula to be sup of the set defines a zero. So each a zero is in ACL of the empty set. We can do it. Now B is an ACL of C, but B is not in the ACL of empty set. So C cannot be one of these elements. So our C must be somewhere inside of these intervals. F cannot be constant on the interval. If it's constant, then this constant will be defined over empty set. B will be in the closure of empty set. So function must be strictly monotone on this interval. Strictly monotone. But then F has definable inverse. And C equals the value of inverse at B. So we can define C from B, because basically function F is invertible. So this actually gives us exchange lemma. Once we have exchange lemma for, in this case, DCL equals ACL, we can basically do the same game as in vector spaces or for transcendental spaces and define notion of independence and dimension. But probably I'll do it afternoon. Thanks. Ooh.